Welcome to Parenting Teens with Dr. Cam, where we tackle the challenges of raising teenagers without the drama. I'm your host, Dr. Cam. Let's get on with the show. Does your teen display repetitive behaviors like excessive hand washing or hair picking? Are they battling against intrusive thoughts they can't shake off? If so, this episode is for you. These behaviors may signal obsessive compulsive disorder or OCD, a condition impacting around one in every 100 children and teens. Today, I'm joined by Kimberly Quinlan, a therapist in extensive training in cognitive behavioral therapy and exposure response prevention for OCD and OCD-related disorders. Kimberly is here to help us identify these signs in our teens and provide guidance for supporting them effectively. Kimberly, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Absolutely. So give us a quick backstory. What inspired you to focus on OCD particularly?
It was luck, really, truly. I originally wanted to specialize in panic disorder and anxiety disorders. I was looking everywhere for an internship that would train me, you know, using the science-based skills, and I was having the hardest time. And then an OCD center here in Los Angeles agreed to take me on. I had never once met anyone with OCD in my life. And as soon as I started treating OCD, I loved it, and I love my clients with OCD. And so it just sort of happened, and I'm so grateful it did.
I love that you kind of fell into it and then you just found the passion in there. It's amazing how that happens, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Tell us a little bit about what is OCD? I mean, we see different behaviors. How do we identify OCD?
Yeah. So first of all, I think I first would say we talk about OCD a lot in culture, about it being like, I'm so OCD about this. I'm so OCD about the way my Christmas decorations go up, you know. And I first want to identify like that is an OCD. You know, if you're finding pleasure from behaviors, that's not OCD. Mm-hmm. So let's just get that out of the way, because OCD is a combination of two main symptoms. Number one, the obsession, which is an intrusive, unwanted, repetitive thought, feeling, sensation, urge, or image. So it could be any of those things. But the main core thing is it's unwanted, it's repetitive, and it's very uncomfortable, right? So that's the first part. And then the compulsion is any physical or mental behavior you do to reduce or remove that obsession. So it could be, you know, in Hollywood, we know a lot about jumping over cracks and checking stoves and hand washing. They are actually compulsions. We know a lot about those physical ones, but there are also compulsions such as reassurance seeking. Avoidance is a big compulsion. And one of the biggest one that most people don't even know the person with OCD is doing is mental compulsions, which is mentally reviewing and ruminating around and around and around, again, to reduce or remove the uncertainty that is created by that obsession.
So that's one that's really hard to even identify, because you don't always know kids or even yourself. Sometimes I would imagine it's hard to even notice if you're doing that, if it's just becomes normalized.
Yeah, yeah. Research shows that the average person with OCD takes between 7 and 14 years to be correctly diagnosed and then get the right treatment. And a part of it is because of our misunderstanding of OCD, but also because a lot of clinicians, doctors, and even the person with OCD doesn't recognize the behavior because it maybe isn't visible, or it's very nuanced and you wouldn't catch it. It sort of goes under sort of general, it looks like generalized anxiety.
Okay. So explain to us a little bit, where does OCD come from? Is there something that triggers it? Is it something we're born with? Where does it come from?
Well, at this point, we don't know exactly. But what we do know is that it is either a combination of just genetics, and genetics plays a huge component, or it could be your environment, the messages you received as a child, the way in which people respond to their own uncertainties and anxieties as well. But we're not quite sure yet. often it is a combination of both. There are also people who have a stressor, and out of that stressor, out of nowhere, that OCD may start and come from that. So we don't know, but that is the common understanding at this point.
So it sounds like it's a response to stress and anxiety. Is that right?
It can be. But not always. So I also want to, you know, I think sometimes people think, well, there was no precipitating factor, you know what I mean? But sometimes it could just be, a lot of my patients will say, I was walking down the street and I had this thought and I felt like my brain broke. Like, out of that moment, life was never the same, that I had this massive whoosh of anxiety and panic and uncertainty. And from there it started. Yes, it can be about stress. It can be also, again, the onset often occurs around adolescence when, you know, hormones and brain development is changing. But again, still, it's different for every person. Some people also, a lot of in social media, people are talking about it being trauma-induced. Yes, there can be a post-traumatic OCD experience for people, but then there are clients who come in and say, I had the best childhood and nothing bad happened to me, but I still have this disorder. So we really don't know.
Yeah. And 1 out of 100, is that's a statistic I saw. That's a lot.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of kids. Yeah. So how can we as parents identify if our child is developing? And is this something that kind of grows, or is it just full on, you've got OCD? Do you know what I mean? Or is it something you slowly, it gets bigger and bigger?
It usually slowly gets bigger and bigger. Okay. There is one other cause of OCD that I didn't mention, which is it can be brought on by another medical condition. We call it PANS or PANDAS. It's an acronym. So, you know, people who've had Lyme disease and other immune conditions can have a very, very sudden onset. However, generally it's a slow progression. Most of my patients say, yeah, I used to do these sort of obsessive and compulsive things as a child, but no one really thought of it as anything, just a bit of an anxious kid, or maybe they're just a little quirky. But then again, it does slowly progress into a disorder.
Right. So is there hope that if we catch it early enough, we can prevent it from becoming a full-blown disorder?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. The good news for OCD is it's highly treatable. It's not preventable, but it's manageable and it's highly treatable, and it doesn't have to be a life sentence that you have to sit and suffer for the rest of your life. So if you're able to be aware of the symptoms and be able to catch them, in some cases now, which is really cool, I've even had some kiddos or young adults saying their teacher was the one who said, I have a feeling you have this disorder. You're asking for reassurance a lot, like over and over and over repetitively. And luckily the teacher was trained well enough to be able to catch it. So I think being able to intervene early is a really important piece.
That is really key. So tell us what we should be looking for, or what are some red flags that should cause us to start looking?
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. This is why I'm so grateful that I'm here and so grateful that you're having me on to talk about it, is really what we want to do is we want to be looking out for anything that somebody is doing that's very repetitive. Mm-hmm. And what I mean repetitive is they're asking the same question over and over again. Even if you've answered it clearly, that it doesn't satisfy that uncertainty.
Mm-hmm.
And often with OCD, we call it the uncertain disorder, right? Or the doubting disorder. Because even when you get reassurance of that your fear won't come true, OCD will immediately say in the person's brain with OCD, it will say, are you sure? And then they'll feel compelled to ask the question again, like, are you sure nothing bad will happen? Are you sure, you know, no one will die? Or, you know, So that's where you can really catch it, in that it's very repetitious and nothing really satiates the anxiety. Nothing really slows it down. So again, we'll go through the main symptoms that we see. So number one, any physical behavior that they're doing repetitively that doesn't seem to logically make sense, like arranging things in a certain way, ordering things in a certain way, checking ovens and stoves repetitively. Another thing to know here, and we can talk more about obsessions here in a second, is OCD can attack any area of somebody's life. It can attack their relationships, their faith, their religion, the things they love to do, their hobbies, their school, their job. And so it may show up in repetitive prayer if they're religious, asking for forgiveness over and over again. Confessing is another one that a lot of kiddos show, like a lot of confessing of, "Mom, I did this bad thing," even if the bad thing was so miniature.
Yeah.
Again, avoidance is another big one. So if someone, you're noticing your child is avoiding something repetitively, you can't catch the rumination. That's one that it's really hard to catch, but you can ask your child, "Do you have any worries that you seem to go over and over and over again that you can't seem to solve?" So there's sort of some of the big behaviors that we see. A lot of that is going to depend on their ability to disclose it too.
Right.
And some kiddos aren't there yet or are too afraid to, because often obsessions can be very taboo. They can be very graphic. They can be very aggressive. And sometimes they're very afraid to disclose the thoughts they're having.
Yeah. I've heard that with the thoughts, because they are often very scary. And so they feel like, "Oh my gosh, something's really wrong with me to have these." So let's say we hear, and explain to us a little bit too what you mean by repetitive, because I want to make sure we're not going, okay, they've done it a few times, versus when does it become obsessive?
Well, it becomes a disorder when it's impacting their functioning and their quality of life, okay, and causing disrupt in the family system, if we're talking about teens and children.
Yeah.
So that's how we would know. I always say to clients, if we were to follow the definition of a compulsion, meaning a behavior you do to reduce or remove anxiety, we could technically say that me brushing my teeth twice a day is a compulsion. I do it repetitively. Mm-hmm. I do it because I don't want gum disease, right? And so we could argue that. However, the reason that us brushing our teeth is not a compulsion is it lines up with my values, right? I'm doing it because logically it lines up with what I believe and what I want for my life. Mm-hmm. A repetitive compulsion is something that is done usually over and over again. It takes up several hours of your day, and you're doing it even though you don't want to. It's actually quite painful to do the behavior. You don't want to do it, but you feel compelled to. And the process is actually quite distressing, because the whole time you're anxious that it won't soothe that uncertainty that you're going for. So that's why us brushing our teeth isn't compulsive. However, if I was brushing my teeth once and then I still didn't feel clean, or it didn't feel right, and then I went and did it again, and as I was doing it, I was quite anxious and doing it with a sense of urgency to get rid of an emotion or get rid of this uncertainty or doubt or whatever it might be, well, then yes, that would be a compulsion. So okay. I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, that definitely does. And it's almost like you can't not do it. You have to do it. Yeah. So we see our kids doing compulsive behaviors or starting to do compulsive behaviors. How do we respond to that? What is the best way to interact with our kid when we see this?
Yeah. So the first thing you can do is just validate and acknowledge how much distress it is. One of the biggest mistakes we make as parents is we just tell them to stop it.
Yes.
and they've already tried that and that didn't work, and they're already in so much pain, feeling like they can't stop. The thing to remember too is in the brain, if we scan the brain, we actually know that the connection between the part of the brain that pumps the brakes on these behaviors is very weak. So just telling them to stop, that's not going to work. They actually have to go through a course of treatment to strengthen that part of the brain, or we can also medicate as well if necessary. So the first thing is validate them. Number two is find them a OCD specialist if you can in your area. That's somebody who can explain to them what's going on and give them a plan to get their life back from this, because you can. The other thing you can do is speak with your medical professional. Again, the gold standard treatment for OCD is a combination of therapy and medication, even for young children. And so you don't have to go on medication. I respect people's decision if they don't want to, but you can speak with your pediatrician, your general doctor, to help with finding a plan that will work for you and your family. So they're the first steps, but the number one thing is if you can also get as educated as you can about OCD, because OCD is very tricky, very, very tricky. Often my patients will say they don't want to do their compulsions, but they can get very skilled at getting reassurance or getting their compulsion done without anybody knowing, just because they're so uncomfortable and they need to do it. So the more you can educate yourself, the better. Now, the last thing I will say here is it's very easy to think about it being your child's and your child's OCD versus the parent, but it's actually not that. It's you and your child versus OCD, and you want to ally with your kid, have rewards, have, you know, make it a game, whatever you can, so that you and your child are allying, so that you're saying to your child, I'm not going to do this behavior, or I'm not going to accommodate your OCD, because there's a lot of accommodation that goes on.
Yeah, I was going to ask parents. About that. Yeah.
We're not going to do that, not because I don't love you. It's just that I refuse to let OCD take over your life, or I refuse to let OCD keep treating you that way. And I love you, child, or I love you, my partner or loved one. I'm not here to help OCD get stronger.
What? And I'm kind of picturing a kid who maybe their OCD is needing constant reassurance or doing something over and over again. We don't want to feed into it, but what do we do instead, because our kids are obsessive about getting it. And so how do we talk about that? What do we do instead of giving in?
So I'm a parent. I understand when you see your child in distress, all we want to do is swoop in and take their discomfort away.
Yeah.
And that is a sign that you're an amazing parent. You know what I mean? However, in the case of OCD, if you swoop in and remove their anxiety for them, you're strengthening the disorder. You're validating the irrational obsession, that thought, feeling, or sensation of urge, by treating it like it's important. And we want to actually not treat it like it's important. And we want to find a way to stand up to OCD. We can actually kind of externalize OCD as a third person, and we'll have a narrative of like, let's stand up to OCD. Let's not let it bully us anymore. We're actually not going to do that. Now, in some cases, the child is begging the parents, please, will you know, and they're in so much pain. It's important that we, again, remind the child that we love them, but or the loved one, but we're not going to engage in OCD, and here is what we're going to do instead. Now, the ultimate goal is, you know, it's not easy, but is to ride waves of discomfort for the child. Instead of doing the compulsion, can we tolerate that discomfort as compassionately as we can? Can we have skills to manage the distress while that discomfort or uncertainty rises and falls. And as a parent, we can be there to support them, help them engage back in activities that they enjoy doing. We might help them with mindset around, you know, standing up to the OCD bully, and we're not going to do that anymore. Or we might just be there to say, I got you. I believe in you. I know you can. I'm here to support you. But again, I think an important thing is it's important to have a treatment team to help them be educated on so that they understand why they're doing that. Because most of the time it feels so uncomfortable, we just want to get rid of the feeling.
Well, I almost imagine it like an itch where, you know, you have an itch and you want to itch it so bad and it hurts so bad and you just want to go do that. And then people are saying you can't, and then you're just focused on it, which makes it itch more. So it almost sounds like we need to help distract them with something else to take their mind off of that obsessive thought.
Yeah, I mean, we have to be careful with words, because sometimes distraction can become a form of avoidance as well. But yes, distraction is important. Distraction in the action of engaging back in value-based behaviors, things that they enjoy. And while we do those behaviors, we allow the uncertainty and discomfort to still be there. But if we're distracting, trying to like get the thought to go away, you'll actually have more of the thought. Right. The number one thing I teach all my patients at the very beginning is the more you try not to have this anxiety, the more you're going to have it. The more you try not to have this intrusive thought, the more you're going to have it. So in the treatment, we actually practice having the thoughts on purpose and doing nothing about them.
Got it.
Doing nothing about them. Now, again, that's really difficult because some forms of OCD, we call them subtypes, can be, you know, very, very alarming and taboo. It can be around harming somebody. It could be around sexual content. It can be around religion. It can attack some very taboo topics, which is so uncomfortable for kids and teens to have to disclose that they're having these sexual thoughts. Or
it's scary for the parents too, because they're like, oh my gosh, what's going on with my kid that they're thinking this?
Yeah. But again, remember, these are thoughts that are repetitive and unwanted, but go against their values, go against who they really are. It means nothing about them. It means nothing about you as a parent that they're having these thoughts. It's just that we know, again, in the brain, that our brain sometimes gets stuck on certain thoughts like a broken record, and it's hard to get unstuck, and it means nothing about the person.
Right. I always think of like the purple elephant when you are telling someone not to think about something, like don't think of a purple elephant. You have to keep checking back to see if you're thinking about the purple elephant, which makes you think about it more. So that's 100%. Why trying to stop the thought doesn't work.
Doesn't work.
We've got to just lean into it, which is really, that's an interesting perception of that too. I think we need. Now, what about behaviors like when they're like picking their hair or their, I've seen eyebrows or picking at their skin or things where we're not feeding into it. We just see them doing it. How do we handle that?
Yeah. So these behaviors are called a body-focused repetitive behavior. It's a little different than OCD, but it's under the OCD umbrella of disorders. Now, the treatment for that's a little different. But similar, but a little different. So number one, research shows that the more we tell our child to stop picking and pulling, the more they have the urge to pick and pull and the more they will, which is frustrating for parents, right? Because, you know, we're the parent. It's our job to tell them to clean their room. It's our job to tell them to brush their teeth. And it's our job to tell them not to pull their hair out and pick their skin or bite their nails. However, we do know, all my patients have confirmed this, the more you say stop that, the more the urge is for them. And they're really dealing with these strong, almost intolerable urges to pull or pick or bite. Again, I would encourage them to seek professional treatment because there is specific treatment for these disorders. And what we want to do instead of just telling them to stop is to provide them with a sensory, in my house, we call it a sensory basket. Mm-hmm. We have one in many of the rooms of our house, and it's filled with different tactile experiences because a lot of pulling hair and skin picking is about touch and tactile, you know, feeling in the fingertips. And so we will have a basket of fiddles, putty, you know, kinetic sand, so that instead of them getting that feeling from their fingers, they're actually having something to play with their fingers. Now that's what we call a competing response, but we also have what we call a habit blocker. So if someone is, you know, picking their skin, pulling their hair, what they can do is keep their nails really short, or some people put Band-Aids over that finger completely, or the fingers that they're actually using. If they're pulling hair, they might, while they're studying, put a hat on because it blocks their ability to touch. Now, it's still hard. That's not going to stop it completely because, again, sometimes that urge is so strong. But again, reward systems can work really well. Really getting clear about the goal for the child. What is it their goal? Why would they be willing to tolerate that urge? What is the goal that they want at the end? And getting clear about that can be very helpful.
Can you give us an example of how to implement a reward system for something like this?
Sure. So the way that I do it with my clients is we have a checklist or a tally system or a jar. And every time that person willingly allows a experience of discomfort, they get a point. Mm. Right? So we call it urge surfing when it comes to hair pulling and skin picking. Every time you ride a wave of urge to pick or pull.
I like that. Okay.
You get a point. And points can be put towards going out for ice cream with your mom and dad, going to the movies, a certain thing you want. It could be for tech time if that's something that's important to you. And you want the goal to be something that they're interested in. Like my son is obsessed with Pokemon. Like I could bribe him with anything Pokemon related. And so, you know, if he was struggling, I would say, you know, for every urge you surf, I'll give you one Pokemon card.
Yeah.
And some parents have a hard time because they're like, no, it needs to be intrinsically motivated. But remember, this urge is so strong in the moment, even adults can't tolerate that discomfort. Yeah. So it's okay that it's extrinsic, and we can slowly wean them off the reward system as they get better and they've developed these tools. Another thing you can use for rewards is rewards for using your tools. So if you're picking up your silly putty and things, you can be getting rewards. For people with OCD, you can be getting rewards or points for how many exposures you do. So for how many, you know, a lot of times if they're avoiding a lot of things, you can get points for facing your fears. Mm. Oh, you're afraid of dogs? Every time you go and you stand within 5 yards of a dog, you get a point. Excellent. Maybe they're working up for the latest Taylor Swift record or whatever it is that they're working towards. That's a way to get them to lean into these tools instead of that instinctual lean away from discomfort.
Right. Now, while we're watching our kids do things that are extremely uncomfortable, it makes us extremely uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. What can we tell ourselves when we're in this, when we're watching our kids and our urge, our compulsion is to remove that pain from them? Mm-hmm. How do we prevent ourselves from doing that?
Well, ultimately, we are going to use the exact same skills they're going to be using. Because while they face their fear, we face our fear, which is our child is in pain. In addition, I have so much compassion for parents because often they've experienced their child have full meltdowns when they've been, you know, they weren't able to do their compulsion, or they wouldn't go to school, or they threw a vase across the room because the distress was so high. And so when we allow our child to have discomfort, it makes total sense that the parent is going to be anxious about how they'll handle it. But we want to think of this. I always say small steps lead to medium-sized steps leads to big, big steps. So we want to let it be messy. We want to let it not be perfect to start with. You know, and we want to use it as an opportunity for ourselves as parents to tolerate our own anxieties and discomforts, our own feelings. So we're surfing waves of discomfort while our child is surfing waves of discomfort. Now, the one thing I talk about all the time, I even wrote a book on this exact topic, is we have to, while we ride those waves, we have to practice immense amounts of self-compassion for ourselves and for our child and our loved ones who are also suffering in this disorder. Yeah. It's not just the person with OCD that suffers, it's the whole system. And so we have to practice, especially as parents, like not beating ourselves up, giving ourselves compassion. If we ourselves don't do a great job of managing our own anxiety, of course, go and get your own therapy, because that is so important while your child suffers. And we need to be practicing compassion for the fact that it's so painful to watch our child suffer.
Yeah. Now, a lot of these I can completely get on board with when it's not harmful to your kid or to somebody else. What if their compulsions are things like cutting or things where they're actually doing some sort of harm? We can't, what do we do then?
Yeah. Well, it's important. I love this question. It's important to know that cutting or burning any self-harm, we wouldn't put in the classification as an OCD compulsion. I rarely see people with OCD who actually hurt themselves, because their fear is that maybe they will hurt themselves.
Right.
There are some kiddos who are in such distress that they do. And in that case, we would first have them be treated for their non-suicidal self-harm. Mm-hmm. And then we would then go to be doing the treatment, which is exposure and response prevention. We wouldn't increase their distress while they're already showing signs of being in such distress to the degree in which they're hurting themselves. So we're mostly intervening with behaviors that they're doing that they don't want to do. Again, not very often does it involve self-harm. That's usually a different and different existing disorder. However, there are some times where a kid is washing their hands so much that their hands are bleeding, mm-hmm. or they're repetitively doing an action so much that they're having muscle spasms and so forth. So that 100%, they're checking a certain, let's say they have health anxiety and they're checking a certain bump on their skin so much that now that bump is bleeding and getting infected. Again, that of course we would then again still engage in how can we get them to reduce that compulsion? How can we give them distress tolerance skills so that they're not having to keep acting repetitively in that way that's causing a degree of unsafety?
Yeah. So I'm hearing we start with the empathy and just recognizing that this is really, really difficult for them, and allowing them to understand that it's not them. This is the OCD monster or whatever it is that we are working together to resolve. We got to let them sit in the discomfort. We're not going to enable the compulsion. Be kind about it, but we're not going to enable it. And we're also not going to constantly tell them to stop.
Yes.
Because that just makes them want to do it more. So we're trying to find other ways to help them surf. I love that. Surf the discomfort and surf that and find other ways to fulfill those maybe tactile or fulfill those needs in a healthier way. What am I missing of summing
that up?
I love
that. The thing that I really didn't emphasize, and that's not your fault, it's mine, is a lot of education at the front end of treatment. Because when you have OCD, you feel like you're going crazy.
Yeah.
Right? You feel like, what is happening to my brain? It, you know, I don't want to do these behaviors, but yet I can't stop. I don't want these thoughts and feelings, but yet I can't stop them. So we do an immense amount of education with the client and the family so that they understand what's going on, which can reduce the self-criticism and the self-blame. And it helps us them to then understand why we're going to have them tolerate discomfort. Because if we don't do that education at the beginning, they're going to say, I'm already in discomfort. I'm doing whatever I can to make it go away. Why would I have more? Yeah. And we have to train them that the more you willingly have it and the less you do those compulsions, the weaker that connection gets and the weaker that obsession becomes. And we can sort of eliminate it or reduce it by not paying attention to it, not making that thought important. I often will say with my patients, the best thing you can do when you have an intrusive thought is shrug and just go, huh, good one, OCD. Like,
thanks, OCD.
Nice try. Nice try. You know, nice try to get me to pay attention to you, but I'm not paying attention to you today.
Like, right.
Every time I pay attention to you, you make me feel terrible and you make me feel worse and you end up making me do compulsions over and over again. So you could come along for the ride, but you don't get to tell me what to do and you don't, I'm not going to give you my attention.
I think it's so important to separate that from the child. For the child's sake, so they don't feel like this is me and I'm not defined by this. And for the parent's sake, because I feel like we're able to be more compassionate and patient when we see it as we're both battling this thing together, yes. Not getting frustrated with my child for doing this behavior.
For sure.
That's really big.
Yeah.
What is the one biggest, and I know we've covered so many things, but is there like one key thing that parents should go do right now if they are concerned that their child may be displaying OCD tendencies?
Educate yourself and get them help. The best resource I can give you is the International OCD Foundation website. It will have all sorts of articles, a therapist directory that they can find professionals in their state or their country. Educate yourself as much as you can on the disorder and get a support system around you. Again, parents, you have to take care of yourself if your child is suffering. So get a support around you so that you know, you're supported so that you can support your child, because there's going to be some hard days. You're going to, as you begin embarking on treatment, it's a hard treatment. It's not just sitting there on a couch and talking for an hour and you get to go home and you feel better. It has a lot of homework. You have to keep track of things at home. So take special care of yourself.
Yeah. And if I would imagine there's probably already numerous support groups out there online and everywhere else. If there's not, create one, because I'm guaranteeing there's other parents searching for something like that. And I know people that have gone out and started their own group and they're like, oh my gosh, where'd all these people come from?
Exactly.
Because they were just waiting for somebody to start that. Mm. How do people find you, Kimberly?
Sure. So I have a podcast called Your Anxiety Toolkit. I talk all about these skills. That's the whole point of that podcast. You can also find me on Instagram at Your Anxiety Toolkit. I also have an online course portal called cbtschool.com, like Cognitive Behavioral Therapy School. It's like acronym, where I have a whole range of courses people can take on how to, you know, if you don't have access to therapy, you can take the course. It's me showing you exactly the steps I show my clients. Nice. So we have courses for OCD, generalized anxiety, panic disorder, depression, and BFRBs as well. So you can go to cbtschool.com. And that isn't to replace therapy. It's really there as education, or if you don't have access to therapy for financial reasons or logistics. A lot of people take the courses even if they're in therapy just as a refresher to remember the skills. But that's there for people as well if they need it.
That's fantastic. And I will put all those links in the show notes so that we can find them. And I'm going to go check them out too. This is great. Kimberly, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. I've learned a lot. So this was wonderful. And that's a wrap. Thank you for tuning in to today's episode of Parenting Teens with Dr. Cam. Don't forget to hit follow so you don't miss a single episode, and share the love by passing this on to a friend. Until next time, keep making a positive impact in your teen's life.